From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Self-driving cars used to sound like sci-fi daydreams, cartoon stuff. No more. If you ever wanted to be George Jetson, just hang on a minute. This week, California passed legislation that will allow driverless cars on public roads for testing. Driverless cars. It's the third state after Nevada and Florida to make that legal. This year, everybody's got them on the drawing boards. Google's got them on the roads. This hour on Point, all about self-driving cars. You can join the conversation. Are you ready for this? So ready or never going to be ready for the car to drive itself? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Monday, Jim Avila of ABC News took a self-driving Cadillac for a spin on a General Motors test track.
Hands are off the steering wheel, feet are off the pedals. I can look away. Don't do this at home.
Don't do this at home, at least not yet. Here's a YouTube video from the TED conference last year featuring some very excited testers of Google's self-driving car.
What?
It's driving itself.
Ah! Ah!
This is amazing, dude. Thanks.
Okay, dude, it's driving itself. We're going to look at the technology, how this will work, the law, what happens to road rage, traffic jams, stoplights. They may go away. Joining me first from Mill Valley, California, is Tom Vanderbilt. He's gone deep on self-driving cars for Wired magazine, author of Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. Tom Vanderbilt, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. My pleasure.
So California's saying that what? They're not loading the roads with millions of self-driving cars yet. They're saying, Google, you can drive your self-driving cars all over California. That's fine?
Yeah, I think, I mean, this is legislation that was, in essence, you know, kind of co-created with Google. There's Google's actually sort of helping set up a lot of this legislation, which has already happened in Nevada and Florida. But it's one of those interesting cases where, as Google put it to me, you know, technology is really outpacing the law here. Google already had its cars driving hundreds of thousands of miles, essentially legally, because there was no restriction against it. So now I think there's just an effort going out to formalize some of this actual testing process.
Okay, so what's coming, Tom? I mean, is it the full, you know, just hop in your car, go to sleep, and it takes you to work thing? Or when people talk about, I think Cadillac's talking about something in 2015, that's not very long. What's first and what's coming?
Yeah, I think we're on sort of a slippery slope here to, not necessarily slippery, a slope to sort of automation that, you know, I should first point out, though, the average driver, you know, may not be aware of this, and they may be, but, you know, cars are pretty robotic already. If we, writer P.W. Singer has a definition of what a robot is. It includes things like a sensor to monitor the environment, detect changes in it, processors that decide how to respond, and effectors that act upon the environment.
Okay.
Anti-lock brake systems are now standard in all U.S. vehicles. An anti-lock brake system is, in essence, a robot. When you go out of control on a highway, you're not, and you initiate braking, the computer knows that it can brake better than you can.
And we know we've got cars that are now looking behind them. We see all the time on the ads, so I don't back over somebody's tricycle.
Exactly. I mean, the average car has more lines of computer code in it. The average upscale car, more lines of computer code than the Boeing Dreamliner. Cars are incredibly automated already. And even sort of more historically, there's sort of this long process where we've been slightly giving up a sense of engagement with the car. We went from manual transmission to automatic. People are using GPS devices rather than looking through maps. You know, there's kind of a whole... And the third thing here is that another thing the automakers are really pushing heavily is the idea of entertainment, increasing entertainment devices in cars, things like Facebook integration in the dashboard.
Okay. I mean, I take your point. There's a lot of driver assistance going on, and yeah, there's all kinds of screens in the cars, and we're supplemented in many ways. But I think to most people, there's a real step between that and hands-free driving.
Well, you know, it's a funny point that's almost, yeah, there's a fine line here. In Germany, for example, they're coming up with a kind of, it's, you know, available very shortly, stop-and-go traffic assist for low-speed congested conditions. It will not only do sort of that adaptive cruise control where it will stop and accelerate for you, it will actually keep the lane. So you're thinking, oh, I can take my hands off the wheel. Not quite. There's a stipulation in the law that says the driver's hand has to be on the wheel, So Mercedes actually, and companies like that, actually have to build a sensor to make sure that your hand is still on the wheel, even though your hand isn't really doing anything. It's just there. And this brings up a big point here, which is that in this line between semi-automation and full automation, what is the role of the human? Is the role of the human there to sort of oversee the computer? Is the computer the ultimate fail-safe system? This is kind of this subtle dance between technology and control that we're going to have to figure out. But we're not, these are the questions that are going to be emerging in the next few years.
Okay, so we take your point. There's a continuum, but America wants to know. I mean, there's Jim Avila with ABC driving on the GM test track, and it's hands off the wheel with the Cadillac. When does that come?
Well, I mean, there's two points. There's when is it technologically possible, and then when is it socially possible? And, when I say socially, there's legal questions. We can talk about that later. But, just to make a point here, in 2009, I was in the back seat of a self-driven car in New York City on a closed track. And it was sort of a big deal that the car saw a stop sign and stopped. And, this was sort of early days 3 years ago. This year, I was in the back of a Google car on a crowded California highway, mm-hmm. and it was doing everything it was supposed to do and doing it better. I mean, I should say that the thing that was most striking about being in the back of that car was not that it was a scary experience. It very quickly became a comfortable experience. What was really interesting was that it allowed me to see just how many mistakes other human drivers were making.
So, was there a driver in that car, Tom, or not?
There was a Google engineer sitting in the quote-unquote driver's seat, ready to, again, kind of be the fail-safe should anything go wrong, but nothing went wrong. And this is not to say something couldn't go wrong, and this is always people's first objection. Well, what about the blue screen of death on my computer that I get? And, we have 300,000 people that were killed in the last decade due to human error and a lot of injury. And so,
So it's compared to what? But in that Google car that you were driving in, did the engineer have his hands on the wheel, or was the Google car just tootling along?
He did not have his hands on the wheel.
Okay.
It was a process. But
how does this work exactly? Put us in that car, or where we're headed here. How does the self-driving car work? I guess GPS tells it where it's going, but what about all the, a huge portion of driving is being ready for all the unexpected things that happen. How's it work?
Well, with Google, it's interesting because, they've essentially taken off-the-shelf Detroit cars and retrofitted them with incredibly sophisticated software, LiDAR scanners. I mean, the LiDAR scanners, which is a form of radar, is probably worth twice as much as the car itself. So clearly there's a cost issue here.
And that's the big gizmo on the roof of these cars. What does it do? What's it scanning for? For the near, the ball bouncing into the street, the car braking in front of me? Is that what the LiDAR does?
Everything. It's a 360-degree representation of the environment, which, no human can do. So there's also some radar sensors. There's a variety of very sophisticated sensors and essentially Google software running the thing, the same product that brought you Google Street Map. I mean, they're all sort of interlinked. And what's interesting about the way Google taught its car to drive is that it didn't sort of feed it the California State DMV regulations and say, here's how to drive. They just went out and did a ton of driving and had the computer analyze what was happening and learn that way, sort of a machine learning process. So this kind of goes against the way we used to think about how we were going to come up with artificial intelligence. And now, this is different from, Detroit's angle. Detroit is also, and the major car companies are going toward automation as well, but they have to work from a different point of view, which is their own cars. They have to make it affordable. They have to make it roadworthy. It's a whole different set of standards than Google, which is for Google. And Google told me, they're not trying to reinvent the car so much as reinvent the driver.
Great. You quote Emerson saying, things are in the saddle and ride mankind. But how do these cars do a simple thing like keep me in my lane or recognize a stop sign? How's that work? Is it camera software combo?
Yes, exactly. Camera and object recognition. And immediately, even with white lane detection, you get into a case here. Well, if the state hasn't been doing its road work and those white lines have
faded,
kind of eroded away. So you need various forms of redundancy here, perhaps including the human.
What about speed limit? Does it have to read the road speed sign just like a human driver?
It does, yes. And this gets into a strange situation where the companies who make cars in Germany have to totally retrofit their software to be able to read U.S. Traffic signs. You could do this in other ways. Just, you could program it into sort of a large map or, through a GPS. And this is another point that people always want to know. Well, will a autonomous cars be allowed to violate the speed limit?
What's the answer? I mean, the speed limit's 65, but everybody drives 73. Will they?
I mean, no one knows. Who is going to provide sort of the master software for an autonomous vehicle? These are, you know, if you gave the power to traffic engineers, they would probably want you to drive a different speed than if you gave the power to drivers. So these would be sort of, again, this mix of social and technological factors that need to be worked out. And clearly there's a lot of issues. We've been driving for, 100 years, and we've still haven't worked out a lot of the issues with human driving. So the idea of autonomous driving is definitely, you prevent some pretty big things to think about.
So we're talking about these being introduced maybe, GM, Cadillac is saying, by 2015 at some level, and others are projecting that within a couple of decades, we may have a majority of automobiles on the road autonomous, if I've got that right, Tom.
Again, it's hard to say. I mean, the technology is evolving incredibly fast. I mean, the idea that we're even having this discussion today is pretty remarkable when you consider what the state of the art was 10 years ago. And again, it kind of boils down to what consumers want to. Do people want to drive? When I say want to drive, I'm not talking about point-to-point individual mobility. We know we like that. But do people want to have their hand on the wheel, or do they want to be phoning their friends, reading the newspaper?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about self-driving cars. Of course, the Jetsons, 1962, 63, self-driving and flying cars were a staple right there in the animated show. They are coming right now to roads, well, California, Nevada, Florida, have all signed off on testing, and more is coming soon. Tom Vanderbilt is with us, author of Traffic and Let the Robot Drive. The autonomous car of the future is here. He wrote for Wired. We're going to hear in a moment from somebody who's right in the thick of this development. We'll hear from the legal side of all this as well. People have thought about this for a long time. In the TV series Knight Rider, 1982-86, David Hasselhoff played Michael Knight, a man with a high-tech car named Kit, which can talk and drive itself. In the first episode, Michael meets Kit for the first time.
I want to know who you are and how you're listening in.
There's no reason for increased volume. I am scanning your interrogatives quite satisfactorily. I am the voice of Knight Industry 2000's microprocessor, K-I-T-T for easy reference. A Kit, if you prefer.
No, I don't prefer, and what's more, I don't intend to drive around in a car that talks back to me.
Yeah, well, just hang on there. That's 1982, Knight Rider, and here it all comes. Tom Vanderbilt is with us from Mill Valley, California, with us right now. From across the pond, Parma, Italy, Alberto Brogi joins us. He's a professor of computer engineering at the University of Parma, pioneer in machine vision and driverless cars, led a team that took two driverless cars from Parma, Italy to Shanghai, China. That's a few thousand miles of driving. Alberto Brogi in Parma, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hello. Hi, Tom.
So what's the biggest challenge here technically for the self-driving car to really come into its own, Alberto?
Well, I think technology-wise, we are almost there. Some legal issues and some acceptance from the public. So actually, I will be talking about more about the technical stuff because actually I've been developing technical issues for these driving cars.
So I guess,
the technology is already almost there.
So talk to us about the technology. What's your approach? How do you lay out the main engineering elements of the self-driving car?
A vehicle needs three things. So the first one will be to perceive what's going on around the vehicle. So some kind of perception with sensors. So you have cameras, you have lasers, you have LIDARs, all the sensors around. Then you need a second thing, which is ability to take decisions. And the third thing will be to act on steering wheel and pedals, so change the speed, change the steering wheel. So we are mainly working on the first one. So trying to perceive what's around the vehicle. We've seen, actually, we've heard about Google Car, which is using the LiDAR. It's a really amazing sensors because it gives you 3D information of around, 360 degrees around your vehicle.
Mm-hmm. It's got 64 lasers I'm reading in it here. It's spinning at 900 RPMs around on the roof of the car, generating this 360-degree view, very, very detailed view all the time.
It's really an amazing sensor, actually. It gives you a very nice view daylight and during the night of what's around the vehicle. The only problem would be that it's a kind of mechanical device which is on top of your car.
Yeah.
So what we're doing right now is to try to use different sensors. So sensors that can be low cost and can be integrated in the chassis of the vehicle. So we try not to disrupt the look of the car. And we're trying to do that with vision, so with cameras. So we put cameras all around and try to get this very same description that you get with the laser scanners.
You know, I was driving into work the other day, and it was morning time. Commuters were coming to an above-ground commuter rail. And they were... these were pedestrians who were walking across the street to catch the train. There was no stoplight. They were going at all different speeds. There must have been five or six of them. And I found myself thinking about this. You know, here I am, a human. I'm looking at each one. I'm gauging, well, how quick are they? How steadily are they walking? How reliably oriented do they seem? Which one do I have to be afraid might fall down? I mean, can the computer really ever match the human eye and mind for assessing in a nuanced, subtle way the potential threats, obstacles, dangers of the highway, Alberto?
Yeah, this is the final goal. So the final goal would be to have a vehicle that is able to really manage all these situations. Right now, I don't think we are there yet because there are so many situations in which the sensors fail. For example, when it's snowing, when you have the sun direct in front of your eyes. So there are maybe when there's raining, a very heavy rain. So there are some situations right now that are not, easily manageable by these current sensors and current technology. But what we need to do now is to, try to push the technology to the limit and test the current technology on a very different set of scenarios to come up with a situation in which it doesn't work. And then try to find some way to fix the problem and maybe also develop some new technology.
A lot of excitement, a lot of advances. The self-driving car, we're told, coming right at us. I want to bring our listeners in. Lindsay in Sepulpa, Oklahoma. Lindsay, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I actually just had a comment about the potential benefits for people in positions like I am.
Mm-hmm.
I live in a rural part of the country, in a rural part of our state even,
okay.
And I drive 3,000 miles, every 5 or 6 weeks for work.
Wow.
And I'm in the office for, sometimes as little as 20 minutes a day, and I would be able to do a lot more if I didn't have to pay attention to the road, especially on long stretches of the highway.
So you would welcome it. I mean, if it comes along, you're first in line. Yes, sign me up.
Sign me up.
I think a lot of people are going to be in that situation if it's just lots of miles and they're not out there doing it for fun, Tom Vanderbilt. They're doing it for work or just because they've got to get somewhere. This gets to the psychological element, but I suppose there are times when people want that feeling of I'm driving, I'm in charge, and other times when they'd be just as happy to catch up on work reports or a romance novel or you name it and let the car do it, Tom.
Yeah, and I mean, there's 2 points to make here. The first is that, as a Google engineer told me, we're not trying to take your freedom away. We're trying to actually give you more freedom. That's not just to do, work things, but think about people who are elderly, have lost the kind of cognitive ability to drive, or people who, you get into questions of an intoxicated driver. I mean, there's all sorts of interesting questions here where, people who might not be able to drive otherwise would be given kind of an increased mobility. And the second point is just that most of the people I've talked to on this issue, it's never an on-off switch. There's a two-part mode here. You can drive fully autonomous when you want it to, or you can take control if you're on sort of a lovely, Pacific Coast Highway and you want that freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of, you know, this is Big Brother overload, you know, maybe a bit kind of oversold.
Oh, I guess, though, we'll see how it ultimately ends up. I mean, they're already talking about putting cars in trains. I mean, not on trains, but sort of in what front to back makes it aerodynamic, makes traffic flow easier in your self-driving car may hook you up with a convoy. I suppose it could, whether you like it or not, at some point. Mindy in Lansing, Michigan. Mindy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am legally blind, and I have a degenerative eye condition, so I did drive for 17 years before my vision fell below the legal limit.
Okay.
So I can see, not well. Mm-hmm. My question is, and I don't know if this is even on the agenda, is are they, and your guest just spoke to this, I would love to be able to drive again. It was probably, you know, I was only 31 when I lost the ability to drive, and it's just been such a challenge. And
just for the freedom of getting where you want to go, when you want to go there, Mindy, I guess.
Yes, and it's been really hard. That's been one of the hardest things about, you know, losing the vision.
Oh, yeah.
So is that on the agenda? Is anyone addressing that? Is anyone working with the Federation for the Blind? And I'd be willing to volunteer to...
Mindy's ready to be the subject, the first test driver. Oh, Mindy, stand by. Let us look at that. I mean, Tom, what this really goes to, I guess, is whether or not this self-driving experience would be a complete experience. Like, let's say you're blind. If you can get yourself into the car seat, are they picturing a car that could take you from that point in your driveway or parallel parked or whatever, wherever it is, and drive you across town or across the state? Is that vision there, Tom?
Well, Google itself did release a rather powerful video, you know, showing a vision-impaired person sitting in its Google car and being driven, and it was really a transformative experience for him. So, again, you know, it's technological versus social, though, and maybe perhaps the legal part of this, we can get into that, but that's kind of where the real, you know, hurdle is going to be. At what point would this even be deemed acceptable?
Alberto, in Italy, let's say you've got people like Mindy, who she's blind, she's ready to do it right now. We've got Mike writing into us, and he asks, would this need to be an all-or-nothing situation? Could you have human-driven cars coexisting in the same traffic flows with self-driving cars? What about it, Alberto?
Yeah, you know, this is a very interesting point, because if you had only autonomous car driving around, all the software or all the intelligence which is on the car could benefit from knowing what, having some expectation on the other behaviors. If there are autonomous cars mixed with human-driven cars, you know, the autonomous car needs to be more, you know, smarter, I guess, because you need to, you know, maybe the other traffic is illegal, is doing something which couldn't be done. Is crossing the road with a red light. So you must be...
Because,
you
know, humans are unpredictable, less predictable, I guess, than software programs.
Exactly. So if we could jump, you know, 50 years from now, we could maybe have all autonomous vehicles around and no one would be driving a car. Maybe that's the future. So in that case, the driverless car would be, you know, simpler than in the next 10, 20 years, where the autonomous car will be, you know, driving around with human-driven cars.
Now, Tom, part of this goes to car-to-car communication, and that's another piece we haven't talked about here. But everybody's anticipating that as self-driving cars became more common, the cars themselves will be communicating with one another about where they are and adjusting speed and direction in response, Tom.
Yeah, that's been a whole other research strand, one that Google itself, you know, hasn't pursued, but that was something that the car companies and other industries have been looking at for a long time. And the whole point, it does speak to a powerful potential here for these sorts of cars, is that the traffic really does work best as a system, not as a collection of individuals. And there's clear scientific evidence that we actually make traffic jams worse by the way we drive, but we tend to drive in them and into them too fast. We have to stop too fast, and there's even experiments where sort of a police car will pace vehicles at the speed that is predicted to be most optimal to get cars through a particularly congested situation, and it actually performs better. So if we could sort of optimize this flow of cars, and again, that car-to-car communication is almost there already with things like adaptive cruise control. It knows where the vehicle is ahead of it. The Google car that LiDAR can actually scan underneath the car ahead of it and see the car in front of that. So it's already looking, you know, past the existing vehicles on the road.
But
so.
There's another step here. I mean, people are talking, I think you and others have written, if we really get into self-driving cars, you might not even need stoplights anymore because the two cars would communicate and one would effectively say to the other, you go through, I'll go through after you, stoplights not required.
Well, I'm not sure what pedestrians will do in that case. So
well, yeah. Maybe they have to be, everybody's going to have something in their ear. Ron in Bowling Green.
We need some traffic control.
Well, I guess so. Bowling Green, Kentucky. Ron, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm okay with the idea of self-driving cars, but in a limited capacity. Like, one of your guests earlier talked about how we're used to cars doing so many more things, like, you know, Facebook and playing movies. So it might help keep drivers safer during those types of activities. Like, you know, people texting while driving, it would kind of take that out of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
I could see it being good for, like, long commutes and driver fatigue. But for, like, dense urban areas or even residential areas where, like, a kid might dart out to the street, I'm not okay with it. I would prefer a human driver in control at that point.
That's interesting. Alberto, in Italy, do you think this will come first to highway driving and later, maybe much later, to dense urban areas? Or is everything coming?
Yeah, you're right. Maybe the first real implementation of these kind of cars will be on freeways and highways because this is a very simple scenario in which all the vehicles flow in the same direction. You have no junctions. It's a friendly environment. Everybody in this field says that actually we are maybe 5 to 10 years from that point. If you're talking about driving downtown, that's a totally different experience, and you have to take care about pedestrians, bicycles, and whatever. So that will be much more complex. And, well, people says that we could get to that point in maybe 30 years, 20, 30 years. But eventually we will get there.
Here's a listener, AC, says, I think it would help with flow, traffic flow, I guess. You would actually be able to increase travel speeds if you kept the vehicles in the system in line with physics and get rid of the human factor of both selfishness and poor decision-making. Could you picture that, Alberto, a future where speeds can actually increase on the highway because all the cars are, computer-driven and talking to one another and coordinated?
Definitely, definitely. If you're in a kind of train of vehicles, so you're one of the vehicles which are going very close to each other at a very high speed, you will not be able to see around. So you will not be able to look for lane markings or traffic signs because you are very close to the vehicle in front,
mm-hmm.
and you're going very fast. So you would be relying on communication between the vehicles. So your vehicle would be communicating with the vehicle in front, would be communicating with the vehicle in front, and so on, so that the first one would be delivering and broadcasting the information about the surroundings environment. So that's the real thing. I mean, we already have some experiments going on in Europe about that, and also in Japan about that. So they have big trucks moving at a very close distance, moving 80 kilometers per hour, 80 miles per hour. It was 80 miles per hour. So it's already a reality.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about self-driving cars, how they work, when they're coming, who's responsible if they crash. California giving the green light this week, the third state in the country to give a green light to self-driving cars out on the roads for testing purposes. Lots of automobile companies looking very closely at this, doing a lot of work on this. The technology advancing more rapidly than many anticipated. Tom Vanderbilt is with us, author of Traffic and Let the Robot Drive in Wired magazine. Alberto Brogi is with us from the University of Parma. He led a couple of cars on an 8,000-mile drive from Parma to Shanghai, self-driving cars. Bryant Walker-Smith joins us right now. He's a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at the Center for Automotive Research at Stanford University, expert on the legal aspects of autonomous vehicles. Bryant, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So who's responsible if this thing runs into the dumpster?
Everybody. In the long term, we'll see a shift of liability from consumers to consumers. by which I mean currently we pay for motor vehicle crashes in the form of insurance and in other payments.
Mm-hmm.
In the future, we're likely to pay for those crashes by higher prices for vehicles, higher prices for services related to vehicles, and lower prices for insurance.
I'm not sure if I follow. If I get into the Google self-driving car and it hits the wall, is it Google's fault?
Possibly. It depends on the duties of the driver. So if I still have my normal duties of vigilance, of prudence, I may still be responsible. If I own the vehicle in many states, I may still be responsible. But then I may be able to turn to Google and say, your product was defective. It crashed. Cover my costs.
In our tort system, where you can sue people for anything, does that make the advent of real self-driving cars unlikely because the liability would just be so great, Brian?
The liability itself is not the problem, because if we understand the magnitude of it, we can actually manage it. We can simply pass those costs on to consumers in the form of prices. The real obstacle, besides the technological questions you've been discussing,
mm-hmm.
is the uncertainty that surrounds this. We don't know what the technology will look like. We don't know how the public will respond. We don't know how judges and juries will respond. And that uncertainty means we don't know how to price these risks. And that means the products may ultimately cost more or take longer to reach the market.
Okay. Those things can hold things up for a long time. Are you assuming that there'll be a period here of shared responsibility where, I can turn to the car sort of as I do with cruise control now, but even more so, I can take my hands off the wheel, eat a peanut butter sandwich, but I still am responsible if something arises for getting engaged? Are you assuming there'll be a period like that before we get to straight out self-driving, go to sleep, it's no problem?
Yes. The legislation we've seen has started to answer the question, can I legally use these vehicles on streets? And that's been a qualified yes. But what states like California and Nevada have yet to really address is what are the duties of the operator or the driver?
And you're expecting a period where there still are some duties, where I can't just shrug and roll over?
Yes.
Wow, here we go. Peter in Providence, Rhode Island. Peter, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for having me. So I got to ride in the Google self-driving car at the TED conference, and what I don't think most people realize is just how well these things can drive. We were on an aggressive mode in a parking lot, and we were laying rubber on the ground, tires screeching, taking curves at 45 miles an hour, and the thing could see everything around us. It was entirely aware of where the cones were, where the walls were. It drove better than any human I've ever driven with.
So you had different modes you could put it in, Peter? Put it in aggressive mode and it becomes like an aggressive driver?
I think for the test, they had that capability, yes.
Wow. And so you were impressed. I mean, it's doing all kinds of fancy maneuvering.
I was extremely impressed. It was driving better than anyone I know.
There you go. First-hand testimony out of the Google car. Thanks, Peter, for that first-hand witness. West Palm Beach, Florida, Jack is calling. Jack, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm skeptical of this program for a few reasons. Number one, driving is one of the areas in life where we still have some degree of control, and it's not clear to me that we in America will be willing to give that up. And I reference the lack of enthusiasm for public transportation. Secondly, this whole program seems to gloss over the value of human judgment, the value of the human computer in our heads in terms of making quick decisions and in terms of weighing choices and so on and so
mm-hmm.
forth.
Yep.
And I guess lastly, this sort of brings to mind the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, where the computer, nicknamed HAL,
yeah.
takes over the spaceship and ends up killing one of the astronauts. So thanks for listening to my comments. I appreciate it.
Jack, I'm very glad for your call. I mean, Tom Vanderbilt, you, I think, noted at the top of the hour, there are all kinds of psychological aspects to how this might be adopted. When it comes to judgment, though, I think you also noted, I mean, humans, with all of our brain power, have lots and lots of automobile crashes and deaths every year. So it's not as if we're anything like perfect, Tom, on the road.
Yeah, I mean, with technology, the thing is that it keeps getting better. There's a Moore's Law. Processors get faster. Things get smarter. Sensors get better. humans are not getting better. I mean, the much touted sort of, you know, gains we've had in traffic safety recently, which are now beginning to be erased, seem to have been essentially because the economy has been in a downturn. People are driving less. I mean, there's been no, it's hard to trace any decline in traffic fatalities to any human factor in the last few decades. It's all because of the vehicles have gotten safer, and now perhaps with technology is getting better. I mean, technology gets better. Humans are, we're kind of stuck in version 1.0.
But there is this issue of control that Jack mentions. I mean, here Benjamin writes us on Facebook. He says, look, I drive a high-performance vehicle, no anti-lock brakes, no automatic transmission. It's one of the most fantastic experiences in the world to me. You know, a moment when I use all my faculties to do something very complex. Driving is very personal, a very personal experience to me, he says. He does not want to give that up, Tom.
Well, again, I think that's kind of the outlier, the kind of the performance crowd who will always be there. But again, I think we need to disentangle point-to-point private mobility, the car gets you where you want to go, versus the actual act of physically driving. If driving were such sort of a rapturous, wondrous experience that maneuvering, distracted driving would not be a problem. People would not be texting while driving. If it was such a great thing. I think often it's not a great thing. It's an incredibly boring thing. It's stressful. All sorts of medical studies about how bad it actually is for you. So yeah, that's the area where you know, I think there's a space for this.
Bryant Walker-Smith, what about some of the more subtle, maybe serious judgment calls? Here a listener writes to us, says, look, will the computer drive you off a cliff to avoid hitting a cat? Will it be programmed to make the moral choice and value the driver's life over another person's life? If a situation comes down to that choice, how will the computer be programmed to morally reason, our listener asked Brian.
Driving and vehicle design right now are about trade-offs, so it's a great question. And what the listener is pointing to is really the question of who decides. Will we each have our own decision to be able to speed, or will we specify ahead of time if we hit the cat or go off the cliff? Or will it be up to engineers or lawyers? Or marketers, will you see campaigns with one company saying, well, we'll crash, but the other company won't?
Yeah, or a dial on the car to say, you know, where do you want to be on the moral generosity scale here? If it's your life or somebody else's, to just program it in? That's incredible. Michaela in Boston. Hi, Michaela. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
This is kind of the broader picture, but I'm a neuropsych student. I nanny a 16-year-old who just got his license, and already, you know, he no longer has to memorize phone numbers because it's all on the phone. And I just have this image of young kids no longer using their brains to drive. I'm just worried about the adaptability, the neuroplasticity of experience being taken away due to technology.
You mean we don't have to dial anymore the number because the phone knows it? We don't have to read the map because the GPS knows where to take us? And now we don't have to drive because the car will do it? Tom Vanderbilt, do we get reduced by this to just, you know, a bump on the log, a bump in the seat?
Perhaps. There's another issue with young drivers in that they're sort of an increasing number is actually giving up their interest in having a license to begin with. So, and this is sort of another, you know, social question about the self-driving car is by the time it actually arrives, what will the role of the car itself be? And there's a great market opportunity here, I think, for things like self-driving taxis, car services, where you whip out your smartphone, call up one of these things, it comes and delivers you. So again, there's a lot of questions here, but I'm a huge user of my GPS system, and I'm sure it's degraded my actual map making, you know, cartographic kind of skills. But again, I would rather probably be thinking about something else than and let the car do the work.
But it's all about trade-offs here, I guess. I mean, Bryant Mouse writes to us, how about a car that can drive drunks home at night? I mean, there are many situations in which people ought not be driving, but maybe they'd be taken care of in this world, Bryant.
Yes, that's one of the legal questions. Nevada has made the explicit statement that if you are operating a self-driving car, even from the seat of a bar, you are driving drunk.
Come again? If you're what?
if you toggle the autonomous mode on your car, you are considered the driver under Nevada law and under California. And Nevada says clearly that means even if you're sitting at a bar drinking, if your car is driving around the street, you are drunk driving.
But so if I'm drunk, the car can't take me home at night? It seems like that'd be a good solution.
Down the road, we sure hope so. And that's the tension between law and technology.
New York, West Seneca, New York, Greg is on the line. Hi, Greg, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering if I will still be able to honk the horn out of frustration, or if the software will take care of that, too.
That's a great question. Alberto, what about it? Will there be emotion programmed into these cars, or is road rage a thing of the past in the self-driving era?
Well, actually, I don't think that we will need that, because we will never realize you need to do that, because when you will be driving, or actually, when you will be sitting in the car, not driving, you will be taking care about something else. So you will never, ever need about worrying about honking to someone else.
So you'll be listening to a great symphony, or maybe writing, composing one. Jeff in Rutland, Vermont. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was going to bring up the other piece of this, which is the sustainability aspect from a global perspective.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to produce 13 million cars a year, because now we can utilize cars that, similar to the zip cars of today, only in an autonomous way. Now you can order up a vehicle, just as one of your speakers talked about. I can order it from my phone. I know it's going to take me 35 minutes to get from point A to point B. So I no longer have to produce the same number of vehicles, which would be impacted to the environment. It'll also be impacted to the economics.
Because I can have the autonomy without owning a car myself necessarily. I'm glad you raised that, Jeff. Tom Vanderbilt, I mean, you reference this. I think you write about it as well, but it may change our whole sense of our relationship with our steed, our transportation. If the car is self-driving, if I can summon a car that will come to me when I need to get somewhere, maybe our caller's right. We won't have to roll as many off the production lines every year.
Yeah, of course, the flip side is a potential negative as well, in which if we don't have to pay as much attention while driving, we can do all this other stuff, that may lead us to actually do more driving, to build sort of more sprawling environments, and to spend more time in the car just sitting there, which is not really a social benefit. We're looking at the first generation, you know, that may die younger than the previous, in part because of obesity, which is somewhat related to the sprawl-dependent relationship. So it kind of cuts both ways here. I tend to think people, there's a limit, a natural limit to which people just don't want to be in the car anymore, and that commutes would not radically change. But it's another important issue to think about.
We're getting down the road here. Tony in Boston. Tony, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Mr. Vanderbilt, I read your book, and I've got it on CD audio, and I've listened to it twice, and I think it's wonderful. A couple of things I think that are missing here is that, you know, you're talking about driving as being boring. It's because people look at driving as a job. But you can actually look at driving as a game. And I do that myself all the time. And the game, basically, one of the fundamental games is don't stop. Make it a game for when you get in your car to where you're going and not
stop. So, Tony, but now you can play a different game. Now you can play chess while you're in the car.
Well, that's a good point, Tom. And what it is that, you know, I'm old enough to remember when PCs came in.
Yeah.
And, you know, when the PC first commercial, when the commercial came out for PC, there was a guy on the beach and saying, you'll have so much time because the PC would do the work. But then what happens is that either companies or people can do more and more and more. And then all of a sudden, instead of it being a liberating thing, it became something that kind of trapped us.
Exactly. So we won't having to be driving on that commute maybe, but we'll be working while we're commuting because we can't drive. Well, I don't know which is worse. One more. Tony, thank you. Michael in Corbin, Kentucky. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What I was thinking is, what about if somebody hacks a computer and it holds you somewhere you don't want to go, or the seatbelt locks you in? Say there's a warrant for you and they haul you from New York to New Jersey or somewhere to the jailhouse, but the whole thing is, in the end, it'll be taking your privilege to operate a car. You'll end up having to have permission before you can use your automobile to go anywhere.
Yeah. Who's going to be in charge? The Big Brother scenario, Bryant Walker Smith, where in this self-driving age, you sit down in the car, and it takes you to the courthouse, whether or not you want to go there, Bryant.
There are privacy concerns related to the government and related to private companies. I mean, imagine these cars are several smartphones, strap them to the inside and the outside of your car, turn on all the cameras, turn on all the sensors, and then link them to your social media. That's an understatement of the potential data collection of these vehicles. Not necessarily the actual, because we don't yet have consumer versions.
But there we go. You get on a smart road, and it's going to know a lot about that road and a lot about you as well. Alberto Broggi, we know you're working and working and working on this. We hear some of the challenges and some of the reservations or concerns, but do you think inevitable, Alberto, that this is where private transportation goes?
Yes, I'm really sure. You know, I'm not sure that we will be reaching that in my lifetime, but I'm sure that maybe in 40, 50 years, or maybe 100, I don't know when, but I'm sure we will get there. Because, you know, there is no reason why we shouldn't do that, because we will get more freedom, we will get less accidents, less casualties, we will get better usage of fuel. So we will have so many advantages. And, I, you know, so far, hearing about the phone calls that we got, you know, the most... the worst thing that was mentioned was that it will we will not be able to drive our own vehicle anymore. I don't think this is a really, really a problem.
Alberto, come to America and check that supposition. We'll see Alberto Brogi in Parma, Bryant Walker-Smith in Stanford, California, and Tom Vanderbilt in Mill Valley, California. Thanks to all of you for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.